One of the jobs as president of the Groundwater Association is to try to conspire with some of my friends and associates and come up with an interesting set of speakers. And hopefully we've done that today. We're going in a couple somewhat different but somewhat related directions. We're going to cover a little bit of the theory side here with our first speaker. And then after our morning break, we're going to have a couple of our more senior representatives, been around the Groundwater Association a while, and have been around Minnesota groundwater for a very long time. Hopefully we'll get a few words of wisdom out of them. And then we have some of the younger crowd covering some interesting areas, particularly Dr. Todd Kincaid is actually going to show us some video of some work he's doing where he's actually, they're trying to essentially swim the length of an aquifer, which is kind of an interesting occupation to try to pursue. And then the afternoon, we're moving much more into where some of the modern thinking on inhomogeneities and how water actually gets through some of our aquifers, both here and in Minnesota and around the world. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Martin Saar. He's one of our colleagues at the University of Minnesota. He's currently the Gibson Chair of Hydrogeology at the University of Minnesota.
Can everybody hear me? Is this loud enough? All right. So thanks so much, Scott, for the introduction and for organizing among with other people this this day here and inviting a really great lineup of speakers. Who follow later, and I'm really happy to give a talk here at this year's meeting. Let's get started. What Scott asked me to do was actually to give a little bit of an overview, or maybe remind us all of the basics of porous medium flow theory, and to then provide some examples of that. And not just of the theory itself, but also of the cases when the theory may break down. So I think that's something that we all want to keep in mind when we think about hydrogeology and whenever we do pumping tests or devise some sort of groundwater flow model, we want to be quite aware of whether it is actually appropriate to use those kinds of models or not. So I'm going to talk about both porous medium flow here in this kind of situation and about open channel flow and some combination of the two as shown here. Porous medium flow, some flow in between grains and open channel flow. But the classic porous medium flow theory only applies really to this porous medium flow situation. So that's what we're going to talk about first, some of that theory. And I just want to say that I'm not doing this on my own. There's my research group. Besides me, Scott is a scientist in the group. He's also working with Calvin Alexander. And then there are three postdocs, Stuart Walsh, Matt Covington, who's here, who a lot of you know, I'm sure. And then there's Pohao Kao, who basically does computational fluid dynamics. And then there are four graduate students working in various fields, such as volcanology. I do some fluid dynamics and volcanology as well. And then hydrogeology and geothermal energy, same for Jimmy Randolph. And then Joe Mir is actually working on numerical methods in the group. So we're branching out more and more into geothermal energy, and that's pretty exciting too. And of course, there are many more people involved, colleagues, collaborators. This is actually only just a partial list that's relevant for today. And there's some former students who graduated right here. All right, so talk outline first off. I'm going to talk about some porous medium flow theory and when it applies. That's going to be fairly theoretical, but that's, I guess, what the idea was, to remind us of the basics again. And then I'm going to look at two examples, porous medium flow at low Reynolds numbers. And specifically, we're going to look at volcano hydrology. I realize that there are at least no active volcanoes here. There are inactive, very ancient volcanoes in this state. But nonetheless, I think that some of what we can see there is applicable to porous medium flow in general. And then I'm going to look at preferred flow paths at high Reynolds number flow in that case. And there we're going to go a little bit closer to home, to Minnesota. And then finally, I'm going to actually talk a little bit about our hydrogeology field camp, because I figure after quite a bit of theory and stuff like that in numerical modeling, it's going to be nice to see some real hands-on field work. And I also want to use the opportunity for a shameless plug for our hydrogeology field camp that I hope every one of you is aware of and maybe we'll send some students to in the summer. All right? So let's get started with the first topic, porous medium flow theory, and most importantly, when does it apply? So when we think about porous medium flow, what we want to think about is the continuum hypothesis, which is just a fancy word for saying that we can average over some representative elementary volume, and we can use just continuum mechanics equations, and that's where the groundwater flow equation comes from. And we have to be quite careful that we are very aware of the fact that if we increase our volume, that we may reach other elementary volumes. And so we're averaging, in essence, over larger and larger regions, and therefore we would be including some other kind of properties. And this is shown in the upper part of the graph, where some property of interest, this could be hydraulic conductivity, permeability, storativity, is shown on this axis versus the volume scale. And at first, you would have maybe at very tiny volumes, you would have very large fluctuations of that property because you're not over averaging over a large enough volume. At some point, though, it stabilizes, but then as you go, if you increase the volume further, you may reach another region and so on. So this is just to say, even though we use the continuum hypothesis all the time in hydrogeology, we need to be sure to be aware of the scale we're looking at and the averaging procedures. So let's derive the groundwater flow equation real quick, or I like to actually call it the hydraulic head diffusion equation, and so I'm kind of on a mission to try and change that name because I think groundwater flow equation is a little bit misleading. So the hydraulic head diffusion equation can be derived by looking at conservation of mass without a sink or source. And so this is the conservation of mass equation up here. What you can see here is the porosity of the medium phi times the density of the fluid. And then if we take the volume integral of that, we get the mass of the in the fluid volume. If the fluid only exists in the pore space, that's why we have to multiply it by porosity. And if you want to look at the change of this mass of fluid in the volume, then we have to take the time derivative of it. And so this is the storage side of the conservation of mass equation. And that must equal the mass flux side across that volume. I drew this volume over here. We have a surface, we have a volume, and there's a normal vector pointing outwards, and it sits in a right angle on the surface. So the flux across the surface is simply the density, the mass flux is simply the density of the fluid, rho, times the Darcy velocity, q, of that fluid, dot producted with the normal vector so that only the flux that actually crosses across that surface will count. If you have flux that is parallel to the surface here, there shouldn't be any change in mass inside the volume. And so we need to take the dot product with this normal vector, which is zero for perpendicular vectors. And then we take the surface integral of that just to integrate over the whole surface, and we get the total mass flux into or out of that surface. Notice the negative sign, that's here because the normal vector is pointing outward so that a negative flux is actually into the volume. Anyway, so and increases, therefore, the mass storage inside. All right, so what we have now is a volume integral on the left-hand side and a surface integral on the right-hand side, and that's not good for further calculations. So we need to apply the Gauss or the divergence theorem and simply turn the right-hand side into a volume integral, which introduces this divergence operator right here. And so it's the divergence of the density times the Darcy velocity rather than the surface integral of the density times the Darcy velocity. And now there's no normal vector here anymore, But we have now a volume integral on either side, which means we can differentiate with respect to volume and get rid of the integral sign, which means that we're essentially looking at an infinitesimally small volume at this point, so it's just one little piece of fluid sitting somewhere. Now, the important part here is that this conservation of mass equation right now has no assumptions in it except for that mass is conserved. And I think we can all agree that that's probably a good idea since scientists established that at around the time of the French Revolution. We're pretty confident that mass is conserved. So that aside from that, there's no assumption that goes into that, and this is quite important for a large portion of my talk, is what are the assumptions? When can we apply standard groundwater theory, and when can we not apply that, or porous medium flow theory, I should say. So let's set this aside. Let's keep this in mind, this equation, for a moment. We can see this Q here. This is the Darcy velocity. So we want to plug into that the Darcy's law for instead of Q. So we have to derive Darcy's law real quick here. Rather than doing it empirically as Darcy did that, it can also be derived from the Navier-Stokes equations, which derive fluid flow. So this is just the continuity part of the Navier-Stokes equations, which says that the density of the fluid times the convective derivative of velocity, which is the local acceleration and the convective acceleration here, must equal the negative pressure, dynamic pressure gradient. That's important that this is a dynamic pressure, plus the dynamic viscosity of the fluid times the Laplacian of the velocity vector. So that's the Navier-Stokes equation, essentially. But we are interested when we derive Darcy's law in flow through a cylinder. So basically, we're approximating the subsurface porous medium as a bunch of cylinders sitting there in all three dimensions or directions at any point in space. So here's the cylinder. We're going to consider only flow through that. So basically, we're deriving Poiseuille's equation right now. We're interested in only unidirectional flow. It only goes in the vertical direction. It's steady state condition, so the time derivative here is zero. The unidirectional part means that the convective derivative right here is zero. It's laminar flow, which means that the whole left-hand side is zero, which it is anyway if those two terms are zero. But that's important that it's for laminar flow. And it's through a pipe, and we're going to do this in cylindrical coordinates. So basically, we're left with zero equals everything on the right-hand side, which is Stokes' equation. And in cylindrical coordinates, it looks like this. Because of the cylindrical coordinates, we introduced this 1 over r term here, the radius. I should say that the radius is given with a small r, and it goes from 0 to capital R. And then there's an angle theta here as well. And then the cross-sectional area is given as A. So velocity only changes as a function of R here, as you go from the center with a maximum velocity to the outside with zero velocity due to no slip boundary conditions. All right, so this is the equation, Stokes' equation in one dimension here in cylindrical coordinates, saying that the pressure gradient, the dynamic pressure gradient in the z direction equals the dynamic viscosity divided by the radius at that point times the derivative with respect to radius of the derivative of the velocity in the z direction with respect to radius. So we need to solve this for the vertical velocity uz. So since the velocity sticks in here within two derivatives, we need to integrate twice. We need two boundary conditions to solve the integration constants. And so here we have the first boundary condition is that the velocity in the z direction is the maximum velocity in the center. So that's pretty clear. And then the velocity uz is zero at the edge of that pipe or right next to the boundary due to no slip boundary conditions. So this lets us solve for the vertical velocity as a function of radial distance from the center, given as 1 over 4 mu times the dynamic pressure gradient. And then here the small r is wherever you are here along r, and then capital R is the total radius here. So this tells us simply what is the velocity distribution from the center to the outside. It's symmetric for all the angles. And, of course, it doesn't change along z either. Now, if you want to get Darcy's law from this, we just need to integrate over the whole cross-sectional area to get the total flux and then divide this by the cross-sectional area A, which is shown right here. So here's the total flux in the z-direction divided by the cross-sectional area A. The total flux of this equation is given as the integral with respect to radius and the integral with respect to the angle. So we're going from the inside to the outside and all the way around here of that function that I wrote up here. And then we divide this by the cross-sectional area, and finally we get the solution, which is essentially Darcy's law, but specifically for flow through a pipe. Okay, so it says that the Darcy velocity QZ is given by the radius squared divided by A times the dynamic viscosity times the dynamic pressure gradient. And I want to point out that this dynamic pressure gradient is similar to what we're all used to from hydrogeology. It includes the elevation head and the pressure head. That's why it's called dynamic pressure gradient in fluid dynamics. And it can be easily converted over to hydraulic head. And so this is now our hydraulic conductivity divided by the density of the fluid times Earth's gravitational acceleration, and equals the permeability divided by the dynamic viscosity. And what this simply means is that the permeability of a pipe is given as the radius squared divided by 8. So there's actually a nice analytic solution for permeability, and of course, therefore, also for hydraulic conductivity, assuming some density and viscosity of the fluid, which for water we know quite well. So this is what I just showed earlier. That's the top of the the bottom of the previous page. And so in what we can in general write Darcy's law is that the Darcy velocity is given as the permeability divided by the viscosity times the dynamic pressure gradient, or if you prefer to express it as hydraulic head, it's rho times g times k, where k is permeability, divided by mu, the viscosity, times the hydraulic head gradient, and then you can replace all of this with hydraulic conductivity. And of course, there's a negative sign because fluid flow happens from high hydraulic head to low hydraulic head, so we have to have the negative sign there. And just in any dimension, it can be written with the gradient operator. So now we have Darcy's law given right here, derived from the Navier-Stokes equations. And but like I said earlier, we need to plug this into the conservation of mass equation that I showed at the very end of the first slide. And here's Darcy's law, and we plug in the Q, this Darcy velocity right in here, and we finally get this form of the groundwater flow or hydraulic head diffusion equation. Now, the important part here in red is that at the moment we apply Darcy's law right here, we imply also that the flow has to be laminar. Okay. So I said earlier that there were no assumptions made for this part right here, except for maybe conservation of mass. But like I said, we probably can agree that that's true. And but the moment we plug in Darcy's law right here for Q, we assume that flow has to be laminar. And that is very, very important to realize. From now on, everything is only for laminar flow. Now let's see, we're going to make some more changes to it, and in the process some more assumptions that we all need to keep in mind whenever we want to use this equation. And we're going to end up with the standard groundwater flow equation. So next assumption is that we're going to assume that the fluid density, rho, is constant in space, although we can still vary it with respect to time. So the density of the fluid here can still vary with respect to time. We keep it right where it is, but we take this one out of the divergence term. So we're going to say the density with respect to space right here, this is the spatial derivative, is constant, so we can take it out of the derivative and move it over to the other side, so it now lives over here. It's 1 over rho. Okay, so it's taken out of here, it's over here. So that's another assumption that we have to be aware of. If you use the groundwater flow equation, in most cases, it means that your density of the fluid is not allowed to vary as a function of space. All right, it is allowed to vary as a function of time. Now, one more thing that we typically do, and then it will finally look the way that everybody has seen it, I'm sure, is we need to replace that left-hand side, the storage side, with the specific storage and the hydraulic head term. So here it is. It's a fairly simple change to make, and we get the specific storage of the hydraulic head change with respect to time equals that right-hand side. And the specific storage is given as the density of the fluid times g, the Earth's gravitational acceleration, and times the compressibility of the aquifer plus the pore fraction times the compressibility of the fluid. Now, the compressibility of the fluid is simply given as 1 over the density of the fluid times the density change with respect to pressure. It's very low because we're talking about a liquid, water. It's about 1.4 times 10 to the negative 10, 1 over Pascal. So it's roughly the compressibility of rock. So the compressibility of water is similar to the compressibility of rock. But it's still very important. So we can't assume it's zero, although sometimes we do. But in hydrogeology, it turns out we have to keep that compressibility in, at least for confined aquifers. And then here, the compressibility of the rock matrix is given as 1 over the aquifer thickness B times the change of aquifer thickness with respect to pressure. Now, here's the last assumption that we're making. Whenever this is being done, we assume plane strain. So this means that the aquifer is actually compressing vertically down, and there's no motion in the horizontal direction as you take water out of the aquifer. So that's usually a good assumption, but not always. So that's another assumption to keep in mind. All right, so what we got now, finally, this equation right here, is our groundwater flow equation, or hydraulic head diffusion equation, because it's a diffusion equation, actually. And it applies to confined aquifers, and for importantly, for laminar flow only. Fluid density has to be constant in space, although you could move, again, this density back in here, but then you're also going to not be able to use this this nice version that we know here. And then at least for, and then we have plane strain deformation of the rock matrix. All right, so that's the groundwater flow equation that we use. We solve this for the hydraulic head H, and then we apply Darcy's law and we get our groundwater flow velocities. So we can only do this for laminar flow. And then we can do the same thing. I'm going to go over this fairly quickly. I don't want to go into too much detail right here. The whole point of this slide is simply to show that here's the confined version that I just derived. It's just in one dimension here. And that we can, in a fairly easy way, move over with some assumption to the unconfined aquifer equation, which is the Businesque equation, which can be linearized. And then we have the linearized unconfined aquifer flow equation. And the whole point of this is simply that here, for this one right here, that's the one I just showed you in the previous slide, the one we just derived, all the assumptions still apply, okay? Because, I mean, we use this equation, we put all kinds of assumptions in there, laminar flow, density not allowed to change with space, all this stuff is in this equation. As we move over to here, all of these assumptions still apply. So what we have now here is the unconfined aquifer equation, still for laminar flow, density constant space, plane strain deformation only, and actually when we linearize it, then only small changes of hydraulic head or water table are allowed. Otherwise, we can't linearize it, which is usually a good assumption unless you're in very high relief topography. So the last part of this more theoretical explanation here is when is flow laminar? You know, I mean, it's fine to say, okay, flow has to be laminar, and only then can we apply this equation. But we need to know when flow is actually laminar. So this can be done by looking at some dimensionless number called the Reynolds number, and it can be derived from non-dimensionalizing the Navier-Stokes equations. Essentially, you're finding out when is the right-hand side of it, meaning the Stokes equations valid, which is from where the groundwater flow equations get derived, and when is the left-hand side valid, which is the Euler's equation of the Navier-Stokes equation. So what we need to, though, be careful is when we plug a velocity into the Reynolds number, we need to use the seepage velocity, which is the Darcy velocity divided by the pore fraction. And then so we can put this in here for u as velocity. We have the density of the fluid, a length scale L, and again, the dynamic viscosity is in the denominator. All right, so if the Reynolds number for our flow system is larger than a critical Reynolds number, then we get turbulent flow. All right, what is a critical Reynolds number? Well, it's roughly 1 for flow around grains. All right, so if we have flow through around grains or around spheres, you want to have a Reynolds number that is smaller than 1, approximately. The farther away you are from 1, the lower it is below it, the better. The more likely it is you're in laminar flow. Well, if you plug in a viscosity and density of water here, you get about a kinematic viscosity of 10 to the negative 6 meters squared per second. And then you can look at what kind of velocity times length scales, these are characteristic velocities and length scales, does that actually apply to in granular material flow? And it turns out that you can pick, of course, any combination of velocity times length here. But let's just say you pick a velocity of 1 millimeter per second, then you get a half a length scale of 1 millimeter here. So in other words, if you have a fluid velocity of 1 millimeter per second and a grain of 1 millimeter, you're getting very close to turbulent flow. So very low velocities, very low length scales, this can happen fairly quickly, fairly easily in granular material flow. And if it happens, your whole groundwater flow equation breaks down. But we don't always have flow around grains. We sometimes, particularly the karst people, including ourselves, are interested in flow through chondrites and pipes and those sort of things. So what's the critical Reynolds number for pipe flow? Well, it's a roughly 2,000 rather than 1. So we want to be below 2,000 if you think about flow being through a pipe so that we stay in laminar flow. And so you can do the same kind of exercise, and you come up with velocities through a pipe of about 2 centimeters per second if the pipe is only 10 centimeters in diameter. So 2 centimeters per second, you know, it's not all that fast of a velocity. Okay, it's 0.02 meters, so a fairly slow velocity, and already you get into turbulent flow. And if that happens, you need to use Euler's equation, the Euler's equation part of the Navier-Stokes equation, and so you're stuck with that. But if your Reynolds number is below that critical Reynolds number, whichever one applies, you can use Stokes' equation right here. And in other words, you can use the groundwater flow equation or the hydraulic head diffusion equation, and we're good. All right. If your Reynolds number is similar around the critical Reynolds number, then you're kind of stuck. That's sort of the worst-case scenario, because what it means is you have to use the full-fledged Navier-Stokes equations. All right, so that was the theory, and when it applies, now let's look at some examples. The first example will actually use this, will be for laminar flow, and it will be for this groundwater flow equation part right here. So porous medium flow, low Reynolds numbers, and the example I'm going to look at is volcano hydrology on a large scale. And it just happens to be one of my research areas where I use porous medium flow theory on a very, very large scale. So my representative elementary volume in this case is actually a volcano. All right, so the whole thing, basically. And so it's a very large representative elementary volume. There's all kinds of heterogeneities and anisotropies there. And we're going to hear about that quite a bit more today, heterogeneities and anisotropies, and I will show some of that later too in the second part. But right now, I'm averaging over all of that. There are all kinds of lava flows, there are faults in there, but I'm saying if you look at it a very big picture, you can actually approximate this as a porous medium, particularly as you go to greater depths where everything gets quite compacted and you're probably in the low Reynolds number regime. And the example I'm giving is actually earthquakes being induced by groundwater recharge and how we can get something that's called a hydraulic conductivity from that. So we can sort of estimate the hydraulic conductivity of the volcano, which is useful for groundwater management in that region or also for geothermal energy resources. So the idea is whenever you inject a fluid in the subsurface here or if you have groundwater recharge, you can actually trigger earthquakes. And when fluid is being recharged, for example, at the surface, the pore fluid pressure actually diffuses down to some seismogenic depth. And that that diffusion of the pore fluid pressure of the hydraulic head is given by the groundwater flow or hydraulic head diffusion equation. And we can, of course, express this also as the pore fluid pressure as shown right down here, where kappa here is the hydraulic diffusivity and P is the pore fluid pressure. And so this is just shows that this equation indeed is a diffusion equation, as it shows that the second derivative in space equals the first derivative in time, as always for diffusion equations. So what I did there a while ago was to look at Mount Hood in the Oregon Cascades. And I noticed when I lived there that in the summer, they report a lot of times report microseismicity at Mount Hood. And I was wondering if this is just due to news gap in the summer and they just need to report about something, or if there's actually more earthquakes in the summer. And so what I did is I looked at seismicity shown here in red as the seismic moment and black as the number of earthquakes versus groundwater recharge shown in blue, which is approximated by stream discharge of runoff-dominated surface runoff-dominated streams. And even just eyeballing it, you can probably see that there's a kind of a time lag between the two. But you can do this more quantitatively, calculate a cross-correlation coefficient between groundwater recharge and these earthquakes, and also make sure that it's statistically significant, and you also get to this but 150-day time lag at which more earthquakes happen than normally, a time lag after groundwater recharge. And that groundwater recharge happens like a pulse because it happened, as you can see right here, on a yearly seasonal basis because it is due to snow melt. Okay, so the snow melts up on Mount Hood, and that recharges the groundwater at basically one point in time. And so there's quite a bit of recharge happening. This is precipitation map. We get about up to 4 meters of 4 meter a year of precipitation, and it's a yearly signal. Time lag is 150 days. The earthquakes are happening at about 4.5 kilometers depth, preferably. So we got to have that pore fluid pressure diffused down to that depth. And basically solve the diffusion equation for this problem. All right, so here again is the diffusion equation shown hydraulic diffusivity, and here's pore fluid pressure diffusion in space and time, just vertically downwards in an infinite half space from the surface. We have a periodic boundary condition at the surface given as the pressure amplitude at the surface times the cosine of that periodic variation, yearly variations of the pore fluid pressure. And I should also say that the groundwater recharge is actually amplified due to the porosity because the water can only exist in the pore space. So, for example, if you had 10% porosity and 1 meter of recharge, that turns into a 10-meter water column. So that's actually quite a pressure signal. And so this diffuses downwards. So what happens is that it gets delayed, and also the amplitude decreases. And so you can solve for that, and the solution of this is shown right over here. All right, so here's the solution again, and we can now... we know at how long it took. It took 150 days to go down 4.5 kilometers where the earthquakes happen. And I should say the reason why the pore fluid pressure triggers earthquakes is because the effective stresses are reduced on the fault when the pore fluid pressure increases. So you're essentially unclamping the fault. So the shear stresses are then sufficient to trigger an earthquake. So with a time delay and a depth, we can now solve for the hydraulic diffusivity, and that can eventually turn into a hydraulic conductivity if you make some assumption about, for example, the compressibility of the aquifer and things like that. So this is an example simply showing that we can use the groundwater flow equation, or again, as I like to call it, the hydraulic head diffusion equation, to in the end, get a very, very large-scale hydraulic conductivity of a whole volcanic system, at least from the surface down to 4.5 kilometers depth. And there's, of course, variation. I realize that. I mean, there's higher conductivities at the top, and then it gets compacted, and it gets lower and lower. And that can all be investigated. And in fact, part of this study is to look at different scales, depth scales, and to come up with a permeability versus depth curve. But here, I'm just showing the part about the 4.5-kilometer depth scale. Okay. But anyway, it will be hard to conduct a pumping test that will give you any kind of information over those kinds of scales. All right. But I should also say that we do pumping tests, as you will see later at HydroChem. And also there, the Tice solution, the Jacob solution, the TM solutions are all solutions to the standard groundwater flow equations. Therefore, they all assume laminar flow. They have lots of other assumptions too, like unidirectional flow and all that kind of stuff. But the laminar flow is really the key point for it right now. All right, so the next example is just to look at something that's not porous medium flow, at least not completely anymore. So we're looking now at this high Reynolds number example, and we're looking at karst. Okay, so that's where the classic theory breaks down. And a lot of you are involved in that kind of research, so but I just thought I'd point this out also as a difference. So let's look at karst. So if you look at the U.S., there are lots and lots of karst regions, and they're quite important, as I'm sure everybody here is aware of. There's a lot of people depend on groundwater that comes from karst or in some way affected by it. And so we're interested in understanding flow there. And later on, we're going to hear about swimming through an aquifer, karst aquifer. So that's of interest to us. And this is just showing some reasons for why we get karst in the first place. For various reasons, but I'm going to move on here. If you look at Minnesota Mystery Cave in particular, I got in this karst thing because Calvin Alexander really, when I arrived here in 2005, gave me a hard time for looking mostly at porous medium flow. And he said, you know, now look at this, you know, the caves in Minnesota, and you have a river flowing through. How are you going to apply your theory right there? You know, obviously it doesn't work. So I got more and more into this karst hydrology stuff. And so this is Kelvin and Scott took me to Mystery Cave and other caves, and we've looked at that, particularly at things like these ceiling features, and the question is, how are these formed? And here's Mystery Cave in I'm pointing at my laptop. Here's works really great, I can see it. Here's Mystery Cave. It's right here in southeastern Minnesota. And so we want to understand how these features form. And, you know, there are many ways of doing this research, as always. Lots of field work. Calvin and Scott do a lot of dye tracing. And, you know, I'm a numerical modeler, so I try to model it. But, okay, we clearly have high Reynolds numbers to deal with here. So... rather than solving the Navier-Stokes equations directly from a top-down method, what we developed, well, other people have done work in this before, but we have developed our own Lattice-Boltzmann code that can actually simulate laminar and turbulent flow and reactive flow, multi-phase, multi-component flow, and all that sort of stuff. And it's a completely different approach from the Eulerian approaches. This is a Lagrangian method where, rather than having this outside observer's view, like in Eulerian methods, like finite difference, finite element, integrated finite difference, all of those, we're actually living with the fluid. Okay, we're moving with the fluid, and that makes things in some ways easier, in some other ways a bit more complicated. But so everything has advantages and disadvantages. But so this is it gives us the Navier-Stokes equations in the end. What happens here is we have fluid packages that propagate about a node lattice, as shown here. We use every fluid packet node is connected to 18 neighboring nodes, and then there's one to it. It's also connected to itself, so it's a 19-speed Lattice-Boltzmann model in three dimensions. And there's always a two-step process, a streaming step and a collision step, where they bounce into each other, and then they get redistributed according to a distribution function that ensures that in the end you get Navier-Stokes type of flow out of it. And if you want to do a multi-phase, multi-component flow, you just add more of these nodes, grids to it, and you can do that very nicely. So lattice-Boltzmann methods are good for complex evolving boundary conditions like we have in caves. They're good for solid transport, multi-phase flow, and multi-component flow. Very good for thermal modeling thermal effects. And they're relatively simple to program. But there's no free lunch. They're computationally quite expensive. So we're also working with computer engineering on using graphics cards with hundreds of processors that you all have in your laptops and in your PCs to speed them up, and we get pretty significant speed-ups. So the problem that we're facing in karst hydrology is that we have different scales, time scales and spatial scales. And to illustrate this problem from a modeling point of view, I just want to point out it is about as difficult as if you wanted to simulate Usain Bolt, who's I think still currently the fastest human runner on Earth, if you wanted to simulate his hair growing while you also wanted to simulate him running. So that's kind of tricky to do. Very, very different scales. Okay, so that's the problem you're facing with groundwater flow in karst, because there's some portions where the water is flowing very fast, and then the other portions where it's flowing maybe through the rock matrix, or what could also happen is we want to simulate the reaction between the fluid and the rock, and they can happen very slowly. So how to simulate more complex pore space geometries and multi-scale problems? In other words, how can we overcome the tyranny of scale? Well, there are multiple approaches, but one is the so-called divide-and-conquer approach, where we just deal with different scales differently. So this is supposed to be a cave. You're going to see this little drawing more. So here's the smallest scale of a crack or fracture here, and then there's some intermediate scale, and then here's the chondrite. So that's one way. Or we can make the most of what you've got. You can use so-called lattice-free methods. And those methods we're also developing where we're getting rid of the lattice and do lattice Boltzmann on a free mesh of randomly distributed, not randomly distributed, but denser distributed nodes wherever we need them. And we can this is actually one of our simulations showing turbulent flow right here around a sphere. I'm going to show this later again. Or that's the other thing that I just mentioned, we can use high-tech gadgetry. So, for example, using graphics cards or graphics processing units, GPUs, to do general-purpose computing. So the buzzword that gets computational scientists very excited right now in all kinds of fields is general-purpose graphics processing unit computing, or GPU computing. So this is what you hear all the time in the supercomputing institutes right now, and the Minnesota Supercomputing Institute is about to get one of those clusters as well, which will probably have tens of thousands of processors. So that's something we're involved too, and you can just see, I mean, graphics cards have come very far. If you look at Pac-Man on the lower left, from the 1980s, how that graphics looked like, and then a simulated image from a computer game in 2008. So these graphics cards are actually very, very powerful, and we can use them for science. So we basically, in a way, you're casting your physical problem in terms of an image. You let it loose on a graphics card. The graphics card has the high-end, we're talking about high-end graphics card, like NVIDIA's Tesla with 256 processors or something, but it only costs about $800 for 256 simple processors. You can actually do some interesting things, and our speed up is some of our lattice Boltzmann simulations went from 1.5 days to about 1.5 hours is the speed up. All right, anyway, so let's talk about this divide and conquer approach. So we're looking at these different scales right here, small scale of a cave, intermediate scale, and large scale. And we're simulating multiple chemical species here. And so in this case, we're interested in karst and cave formation. So we have a calcium carbonate rock. We have calcium ions, CO2 ions. And then in here you can see we have just a concentration gradient of CO2 and also of calcium ions. So just some comparisons between the analytic solutions shown as the probably not really visible on this gray line, but it's right underneath the dots, which are the model simulation of a diffusion problem. It's just the error function, the solution here. You go from a step function of concentration versus distance from the wall, and then over time, you get the typical error function shape. So it seems to be working quite well for diffusion. For dissolution, we can compare our results to the classic Stefan moving boundary problem, which is the problem of if you have a solid and a fluid and you erode the solid by a reaction process, how fast is this boundary stepping over or moving away? So from 0 to 0.2, 0.4, and that's showing up here, 0, 0, 2, 0, 4 on the y-axis, and then over time. And again, analytic solution in blue and then the model in red. And then once we have confirmed that, we can actually simulate fluid flow through a fracture, and then its dissolution over time as you see how this gets widened here. I think this is concentration of CO2. So we can go to the wishing well in Mystery Cave. This is a LiDAR image. I'm just wiggling it around a little bit so you can actually see the three-dimensional aspect of it. Turns out when it moves, you can immediately sort of see that. And so we're trying to eventually simulate fluid flow through a karst system like that. At the intermediate scale, what we have to do is we can't solve things explicitly anymore. So we have to use a rate-controlled dissolution model where we first find the steady-state steady fluid flow solution and the dissolved solids. And then this is here in this crack. Then we look at calculate the dissolution rate and then update the boundaries. And so what you get in the end is from our LiDAR example, we see this sort of opening right here. This is an actual cross-section through it, fluid in black, rock in gray. And so we can simulate this. Of course, it's nicely symmetric in the computer model, but it looks roughly in the end, at least on some level, like what we see on the right-hand side. And eventually what we want to do is to constrain this with actual LiDAR images. And finally, at the largest scale, we cannot really simulate even at that earlier level of detail. So we have to rather than using an explicit method, we use a partial bounce back implicit method to solve our Lattice-Boltzmann code. What this means is we're going back from Lattice-Boltzmann to a continuum description. And so we're using Lattice-Boltzmann methods again and introduce a permeability tensor. Before, when it's just flow through a conduit or through some complicated pore space geometry, we don't need the permeability tensor. So that's nice, but you need the exact description of the conduit. Okay. Now, in porous medium flow, so that would be true for this part right here. But in the porous section right here with randomly distributed permeabilities, there maybe we can express this as with permeability tensors again. So what we want to be able to do is be able to simulate porous medium flow with permeability tensors, but then Navier-Stokes flow through the channels, and then also have reactive transport to be able to widen these channels. Or if we have mineral precipitation like we're looking at for CO2 sequestration, we want to be able to also shrink these channels. And we want to be able to do this all with one code and also include solute transport, heat transport, multi-phase, multi-component flow. And so that's what we're doing. and you want to do this without having to remesh whenever you change this boundary. So to show that the code is actually working, again, some comparison between model and analytic solutions. The model is given as the dot right here. Here's the analytic solution that's right on top of each other. This is for advection and diffusion, so it's not just diffusion anymore. That's why it doesn't look like an error function. but it works quite well. We can simulate adsorption as well. So if you go have an adsorption coefficient of zero, it's the previous solution, and then here we have increasing adsorptivities. So that can be done. This is just showing 2D solutions. This is on the left-hand side and compared to an analytic solution. Again, we can't see the gray, but it's right underneath the black of the model. So the point is, again, the model and the analytic solutions agree exactly. This is for a pore fraction of 40%. And then we go to heterogeneous porosities. So now there's no analytic solution anymore. So we compare to COMSOL multiphysics. So we do a COMSOL multiphysics simulation. Again, the gray behind the black, and the black is the Lattice-Boltzmann code. And you can see there's a pore fraction of 40%, pore fraction of 10%. And these are just the lattice units, and the contours are the concentrations of the solute. And finally, this is just to demonstrate that, I'm going to skip this for most part, but we can have anisotropic dispersion tensors, so you don't have to have isotropic dispersivity either. And again, analytic solutions versus our model agree. So just to recap, what we want to do here is we want to solve the Navier-Stokes equation shown right here in the channel, and we want to solve the groundwater flow equation, the porous medium, except for we don't solve either one of them. We use the Lattice-Boltzmann approach, and we get those out of it. So it's a bottom-up approach. And this is just to show that we do get the right results. This is the pressure field of flow around a sphere. These are the flow lines of flow around a sphere. And then finally, the vorticity of flow around a sphere. And so what you should see, if this is done correctly, is a von Karman vortex street of eddies actually decoupling here. And stop these other ones and see if... What you should see here is are the eddies decoupling eventually. It's kind of stuck right now. Here we go. And once you reach steady state conditions at a Reynolds number of 120, so it's way above 1, you see these vortices here coming off. So it shows us that the simulation seems to be doing the right thing. And so finally, what I want to show here real quick is now the exciting thing is combining this open channel Navier-Stokes flow with porous medium flow, with solute transport, and with reactions. So here it is. You have your porous medium. You have an opening here. Fluid is undersaturated in calcium ions, is entering, and it's dissolving the porous medium. It's forming a preferred flow path like we see in karst systems. And over here it's just showing the same thing, but the concentration. And the partial CO2 concentration or partial in partial atmospheric pressure. And so over time, this grows, and like I said, the flow is turbulent in here and then laminar on the outside. And so now the next challenge is to compare it to LIDAR images of caves in some situations. So this was pretty theoretical or numerical, either way you want to look at it, but I hope that what I have shown is that we have to be careful when we use the groundwater flow equation, that it has to be laminar flow, that there are some other assumptions there as well, and that there are methods to deal with non-laminar flow, but we just have to make sure, first off, that we're aware of that happening. So we want to calculate the Reynolds number. So finally, what I want to show is that we do quite a bit of field work as well. I'm in particular Hydro Field Camp that Calvin and Scott and I are running, and Olaf Funkuch has done that also for many years. And so I want to just give you some impressions from Hydro Camp, and then I'm done. So just a little advertisement. Maybe some of you want to tell students or you yourself may be interested in joining us. It's GEO4971W for undergraduate credits and GEO5971 for two graduate credits. It's, of course, at the University of Minnesota. It has a website where it's all kinds of information on here. And next year we will have it from July 12th through August 1st. The first week is held at the campus in Minneapolis, and then weeks 2 and 3 are held at the Portage Nature Reserve up in north central Minnesota. And we do all kinds of things. We do groundwater lake interactions. We look at karst systems. We look at weather aspects of the hydrologic cycle. This is our field site. It sits right here, this square. There are multiple wells. Scott, are we up to 15 now, I think? We just installed our second pumping well last year. We had Braun Engineering help us put another well last year. We have the USGS put another well. Every year we add another monitoring well, and we do groundwater table mapping and all kinds of fun exercises. So hydrogeologic mapping and surveying is part of it. Water quality sampling, drilling and installation of new monitoring well, borehole geophysical techniques where we use stream gauging, aquifer testing. Of course, we do a long-term pumping test over several days, at least if everything works out fine. We do also slug tests and the whole thing. A tiny little bit of modeling, not very much. And this is Deep Portage, where we stay for the second and third week. It's really fun. This is some impressions from the well drilling that happened a few years ago. Scott, you can see him over here working. Here's one of the monitoring wells. This is when we do a pumping test. We measure the flow rate by letting it go into a trough. Scott's trying the water here. We do water temperature tests. this is Ben. So that's always fun, particularly if it's a really hot day. This is actually Ravi, a student of mine, a PhD student who does geothermal stuff now, but I had him join HydroChemp as well. And this is a data logger and monitoring one of the many monitoring wells. And we also do hand measurements, all kinds of. We try to do everything from very low tech techniques to the higher end technology part, so that students really get exposed to a wide range and can work in companies and have a good basis, a good background to then be more trained from that point. And then at Deep Portage, we set up our own network, wireless network. We bring a laser printer and we have screens, and we show them the whole like theory that I just showed you, plus a lot more, and we have them write reports and analyze their data. And so it's actually a writing intensive course. That's why there's a W. So it's a lot of report writing, and we think that this is very good for as a practice to work in an environmental or hydrological consulting company where they have to write reports all the time. And we have students and sometimes hydrology professionals attend this. This is just an example of one of our curves, of our TICE pumping test curves. This is from 2005. Now we have a lot more curves there. Groundwater lake interactions, that's really fun to do. Stream gauging. This is, of course, the origin of the Mississippi River and HydroChem 2006 crew. We've gone up to 32 students in the past, so we actually now had to turn some students down. So we have a pretty rigorous sign-up procedure. And again, the website is shown over here. If you can also just Google HydroChem, and it's one of the first hits you will find. Here's Calvin. Here's Olaf. I'm over here. Scott's here, so we're all involved in this. It's actually my favorite course to teach at the university. So that was the ad for HydroChemp, and now the conclusion, the very last slide here. I want to just point out that porous medium flow theory works great if it is applicable. Okay, so it is a nice theory, and there are many regions where it works really well. Always, though, be careful about anisotropy and heterogeneity. And that's part of the equation, so you can have that as part of it, no problem. But if you get into turbulent flow, it doesn't work anymore. solution of Full-Navier-Stokes flow or Euler's equation is required for high Reynolds numbers. For example, Karst is an example. Although there are alternative techniques to solving the equations directly, you can use, for example, Lattice-Boltzmann simulations, which is that next point. And then finally, I want to say that hands-on fieldwork is invaluable. See HydroChem to gain practical experience with ground water flow over a wide range of scales and flow regimes. And me being a modeler, I really appreciate the experiences of teaching HydroChem and being out there. It's a great thing. I think you want to keep that in mind for if you hear somebody wanting to get a hands-on experience, to send them our way. Google HydroChem and have them sign up. And finally, I just want to say again, Scott mentioned it already, save the date, May 15th, 2010. Our colleague and friend Olaf Funkuch will have he's retiring next spring term. This upcoming spring term is his last semester to teach. Olaf has been a great friend and mentor. In fact, he was the head of the search committee that hired me, so I'm very grateful for that. Anyway, but of course, some of you know him much longer than I have. I've known him since 2003, since I applied. But it would be great to have a whole bunch of people come to this May 15th mini conference that we're going to have in his honor. All right.
Do we have any questions for Martin? We have a few minutes.
When the stability of a dam is
created, yeah, there's an analytic solution. It's the BJK Buxkander. I forgot exactly the name. So it's a classic solution that takes the original Boltzmann equation, which are actually for gas molecules of an ideal gas, and comes up with a redistribution of the fluid density. So what happens is when these fluid packages hit and collide and they get redistributed, it's actually the densities and the velocity, so essentially the momentum that gets redistributed. And this has to be done in a certain way so that the original lattice the original Boltzmann equations are preserved for this lattice situation. And it's very important to do this correctly, because you could come up with all kinds of collision rules that would even give you the look of fluid flow, but it would not be absolutely correct. It would not end in Navier-Stokes type of flow. So sometimes in the movie industry, they only are interested in looks of fluid flowing on animated movies. So they would, for example, plug in a different collision rule that's simpler to calculate for a big movie and lots of water moving around. And it doesn't matter if it is not absolutely correct from a scientific point of view. But if you want the density redistributions to be done correctly so that you get real Navier-Stokes flow out of it with the real pressures and velocities and everything, the dynamic viscosities and so on, then you have to follow those redistribution rules. There's no parameter in it. It's an analytic solution. It's exact. So it works exactly in this case. There are other things that are, for example, within certain ranges, there are basically you can tune in the exact viscosities that you want for the fluid, for the partial bounce back method, the exact permeability. We found an analytic solution that relates the permeability you want the partial bounce back lattice Boltzmann fluid flow to go through you have to translate that into the lattice Boltzmann world. And so we found an analytic solution for that. So there are actually lots and lots of examples where there's analytic relationships between the physical real world and the lattice Boltzmann world, so there's no approximation. But sometimes the problems, I would say, where we do run in are two main problems. One is, I mentioned, the computational cost of it. And the other one is for very low pore fractions for the partial bounce back porous medium lattice Boltzmann, we get instability. instability in the sense of computational instability.
Any other questions?